Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Mason DeBuff and Foster Lemkow, rising seniors from Aspen and Glenwood Springs High School, respectively. They will be interviewing Sean McWilliams from West Virginia University. Sean is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at West Virginia University, and he received his PhD in physics from the University of Maryland and held postdoctoral fellowships at NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center, Columbia University, and Princeton University. His research focuses on making theoretical predictions for the detailed gravitational wave signatures from pairs of black holes at all mass ranges, from masses comparable to the Sun up to masses tens of billions of times that large.
Thank you for having me. Gravitational waves are these ripples in the space-time that Einstein told us permeates the universe. So when really massive, dense objects like black holes, which are the ultimate collapsed stars, or neutron stars, or another type of dense star, when they are in pairs swirling around each other, they're stirring up the space-time, sort of like, you know, as you're dipping your oar into the water, it's stirring up the water around it, and waves are rippling out. So the same phenomena happens in the space-time. And I work on a variety of ways of trying to observe these at all different ways. We use stars that are out in the universe called pulsars, and we time them and look for changes in the time of arrival of these pulses from a passing gravitational wave, or experiments that we build both on the ground and in space.
So you work with LIGO, correct?
Yes.
What exactly is that, and how did it facilitate the discovery of gravitational waves?
Well, LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, and so LIGO is less of a mouthful. So it's an experiment on the ground, and it's actually, there are two facilities, one in Livingston, Louisiana, and the other in Hanford, Washington. They're each 4 kilometers or 2.5 miles long on each side, and they make a letter L. Okay, so it's two arms, each of them that long, and what they're doing is they're shining laser light up and down each arm. And the laser light comes in, a single laser shines in sort of at the crux of the L and shines down each arm, bounces off mirrors, and actually bounces around in the arms for a while, then is brought back together and interfered with each other. The light down each arm is interfered. And if nothing is going on, the interference pattern is just sitting there. It's the same all the time. Now, a train passing by, any sort of thing can disturb that. So the challenge experimentally is to make nothing mess with that. So it's just sitting there, you know, it's a static interference pattern. What happens when a gravitational wave goes by is one of the arms changes its length relative to the other arm. So the interference pattern, the path that the light travels down each arm is a little different, and the difference varies over time. So we see that change, that oscillation in the interference pattern, and that's the hallmark signature of the gravitational wave. The sources out in the universe that we're looking for, we can predict what that signal will look like, and so then we look for signals that look like that in the data.
You talked a bit about how difficult it is to produce the circumstances in which you can observe gravitational waves. Are there any major technological developments that you think have made it possible to do so to kind of nowadays when it wasn't possible years ago when people, I believe, were still talking about it and still looking?
Absolutely. So this has been a long, like a 40-year endeavor trying to see these experimentally. And the approaches that people used in the past, we now know, had no hope of seeing anything. But we didn't know that then. And even if we thought we really understood the universe, it's still worth looking. And we couldn't have had the instruments we have today without those earlier generations building things up. But as far as the technology that's in the instrument, it is the most precision measurement in the history of mankind. So it is the absolute forefront of technology. The stuff that makes that possible wasn't available 10 years before. And the continued advancements, as we have plans to get better and better with the facilities we have over the next 10, 15 years, and then build even better facilities. Well, why not just build the best one now? The answer is we can't. The technology isn't available to do it. You have to actually invent the hardware to make the thing work.
What do you specifically do at LIGO?
I rave about the experiment all the time because I'm a theorist. So I struggle to imagine how these guys make these things work. So what I do is on the side of predicting what the signal will look like from different astronomical events. So when these measurements are made, lots of things are it's not actually, there's no signal there. There's noise. All of the different components do little bumps and jerks and whatnot. And so there's sort of a constant fizzling in the data. And buried in that, we always hope, are signals. But in order to pull those out, the best way to pull it out is to have some idea of what you're looking for. That's the optimal way to find it. So what I have worked on since my PhD, so my PhD was primarily simulating in supercomputer simulations what the collision of two black holes would look like. Those are very expensive. They take sometimes weeks to generate for one case. We want to predict what it will look like for every physical situation that could possibly generate these. So to do that, you have to sort of take insights, learn from the numerical simulation. So that's kind of my experiment, is the numerical simulations, and I look at what I get out, and I try to draw conclusions of sort of simple physical principles that could explain what I'm seeing, and then predict what the signal will look like everywhere in the relevant parameter space.
And how is this research and kind of gravitational waves in general relevant to discussion of Einstein's general theory of relativity?
So there's been a lot of attention paid to, this was a prediction of Einstein's theory. It's actually a nice example of how science works, in that it was Einstein's prediction, and then it wasn't, and then it was again, because he oscillated back and forth in terms of whether he thought gravitational waves really existed. And that was actually a controversy for a long time, well into the 50s, right? In his theory he put out in 1916. So that's kind of how science works. But we landed on believing these are a real event, and it's a really powerful confirmation of his theory, in the sense that all the confirmations we had up to this point, the most famous one being seeing the position of stars move a little bit when they're behind a total solar eclipse, because the light is bending around this curving space-time. But the gravity is actually pretty weak, believe it or not, right near the sun, even right near the edge of the sun. It's pretty weak compared to what we're talking about. So this is the most spectacular extreme gravity situation you can imagine. So if you think what particle physicists do, how do they understand what's happening with particles? They smash them together as hard as they can and see what comes out. That's what this did. It took two black holes, smashed them together at near the speed of light, and saw what came out. So that's sort of the most fine detail test you could imagine doing of general relativity.
You mentioned a little bit about the history of gravitational waves and research about that, but do you think you could go a little bit more in depth about that?
So, I mean, the theoretical work is what I was talking about, started with Einstein, and then lots of people sort of jumped in when they realized this was pretty revolutionary. But experimentally, through the late 60s was really when things started getting rolling in earnest. There was Joseph Weber, who actually was a professor at University of Maryland, where I graduated, and he built what are called bar detectors, basically large aluminum or what have you metal bars with sensors on them, and they were trying to probe actual mechanical deformations in this material. He actually claimed to have seen gravitational waves, and it was a controversy for a while. We were very confident he did not, and it sort of reinforces the idea that you need brilliant experimentalists, but you also need data analysts and people who predict what the signal looks like. All of them have to work together. Nobody can sort of do this alone. So that was the state of the art for quite a while. And then into the 80s, this idea of a laser interferometer had been around, but it didn't really get serious funding until the 80s from the National Science Foundation. And so a prototype was built at Caltech, and then the funding came through from NSF to build these two instruments, and it's pretty spectacular. You know, we're going to fund not only one, but two of these massive instruments. And part of the reason was learning from Weber, you can't believe what you see if you just see it once. If you see it in two different detectors, each on opposite sides of the country, then that instills a lot more confidence. So for a long time, these detectors were being built and improved, and the initial LIGO really didn't have any realistic expectation of seeing anything. It was more a technology demonstration, going back to the technological development we were talking about. They had to invent the thing. They had to make things that could eventually be sensitive enough. And then finally in 2015, we had advanced LIGO, which was sort of the culmination of all those decades of effort, and it was finally sensitive enough.
To kind of change the course of the conversation onto you personally, how and when did you first gain interest in physics?
I liked physics in high school. It was different from the other coursework. It seemed more creative and imaginative, and it seemed to be the background of everything else. Sort of, you know, learning about chemistry, and would memorize all these orbitals and such and say, well, why? Oh, well, because of quantum physics. Oh, okay. Well, you know, I want to know why. I want to understand the why, not just memorize, not to denigrate chemistry. It's wonderful science, but it's based on physics. So I had talked with my father, in particular, who was an engineer, and he had started out studying physics and moved to engineering because, in his words, the physics was too hard. My brother had also started in physics and moved to engineering because, in his words, it was too hard. So being a, you know, cocky young kid with a chip on my shoulder, I thought, ah, well, if they can't do it, but I'll do this, a piece of cake. So that sort of was the initial push. But once I got there and started studying things, in particular doing research into black holes, there was no turning back. I mean, I was definitely hooked on the subject matter from that point.
Astrophysics specifically, when was your first experience, like, learning about that?
I was always, I mean, even as a kid, I would just consume every, you know, PBS, Nova, Black Hole, Stephen Hawking, you know, whatever I could get my hands on. So I was fascinated from day one on, you know, these crazy things happening out in the universe that are, so, I mean, I talking about these black holes colliding in sort of a clinical way, but it's kind of insane to stop and think about that this is happening out in the universe. And so that struck me even as a kid. And so I say I went into physics. I mean, I right from day one, I was double majoring in physics and astronomy, astrophysics, because it was, I love the understanding of why and what goes on sort of behind the scenes. But the place where physics gets stretched to its limits is out in the universe. We really can't build things that can, right? We can't build anything that generates gravitational waves that we could ever see, for instance. We can't build anything that generates particles as energetic as the cosmic rays that flood in on us all the time. So the universe is doing things beyond our imagination. So I always knew that was sort of the application of physics that was of most interest to me.
What would you say, in your experience, has been the most fulfilling part of being a physicist?
Teaching, and the few times where someone will come in and I'll often hear, oh, I can't do math, and that sort of thing. And me taking a step back and trying to relate, you know, my brain works differently. I have different strengths and different weaknesses from whoever I'm trying to engage with, and trying to really understand, all right, what is the hang up? Because it's not the case that people can't do math. Anybody can do math. I'm sorry. You absolutely can do math. You just, you know, you have to think about it the right way. There's different tools that'll help you sort of understand it. So building that skill set of being able to help other people sort of get over that hump and start getting that sense of wonder about the universe, and that they can sit down with a pen and paper and explain some of these things themselves, has been, I think, the most fulfilling part.
How exactly has that kind of transition to being more of a professor and kind of leading student research been for you?
A big adjustment. I won't lie. My favorite part of being a physicist is sitting down myself with the pen and paper and working these things out and solving these problems. I love it. The adjustment has been, I learned a lot of these things 15 years ago. At this point, they're as natural as breathing. Someone else has come to this and you know, it's not obvious how Newton's laws must work and things like this. So that sort of realizing what is not really intuitive, it's just been repetition, and, you know, learning how to describe things in a way where I'm not having all this background assumed knowledge. That's been sort of the biggest adjustment for me, I think.
Mm-hmm. You said that LIGO is constantly, or technology needs to keep advancing. What do you think a LIGO would look like in 50 or 100 years? And
one definite direction that things will go is the instruments will get bigger. So we have these limitations on the measurement we can make. The one limitation is the motion of the Earth. And not that it directly disturbs the instrument, but actually what happens when the ground is moving is it's getting a little denser and a little less dense in waves, and therefore the gravity of the ground under the detector is changing in time, pulling on the test masses a little bit differently. That is a limitation, a fundamental limitation, which gives you a sense of how sensitive these instruments are. on the other end, it's the actual, so at higher frequencies, so on shorter timescales when we're trying to make measurements, it's actually that the laser is made up of individual photons, and the shorter time interval we want to look at, the fewer photons are there, and we eventually run out of photons. So those are the limitations. So as far as going into the future, you can address those by making a bigger instrument, by putting in more powerful lasers, by cooling down the different components cryogenically. The most of the ground noise that I talked about comes near the surface, so you can go underground. So in the future, from the ground, what it'll look like is a really enormous, you know, incredibly long detector that's underground, cryogenically cooled with all sorts of exotic isolation mechanisms, etc. The other thing you can do, in particular for the ground part, is go into space. And so that's another area of research that I'm very much focused on, is building an instrument in space. Then you don't have to worry about the ground at all. And so we hope to, not even on those long of timescales, but more in the sort of mid-2030s, to have an instrument out in space where three satellites are shining lasers back and forth. I mean, it sounds crazy, but we've actually demonstrated that we can do every technical piece that's necessary for this. So we're kind of way ahead of the game in building that. So 50 years into the future, we build even better, even bigger instruments along those lines as well.
Can you describe some of your early research, perhaps during your PhD or maybe during your undergrad, and how did that really shape like who you are and what you study today?
As an undergrad, I mentioned I got into working with Professor Pablo Laguna at Penn State, who was working on what's a field called numerical relativity, which is trying to simulate Einstein's equations in a supercomputer. And at that point, the problem of colliding pairs of black holes couldn't be done. So you'd put these complicated equations in the supercomputer and you try to, okay, ready, go. And the black holes would move a little bit and then the code would crash. And for 30 years, the code would crash. And that was the way things sort of remained, but it was an exciting challenge for me. So when I went to Maryland for my PhD, one of the forefront numerical relativity groups was right next door at NASA Goddard. So I did my dissertation research with them. And actually that was during the time period that this problem finally gave way, finally was overcome. And these simulations went from moving the black holes a tiny bit and then crashing to being able to have them orbit for dozens of orbits and collide with each other and form a final single black hole, and that single black hole settle down, and we can, quote unquote, easily do that, right? You almost take it for granted now. Easily do that for almost any physical case we might be interested in. I guess the second part of your question was, how does that affect the research I do now? Well, that was a super exciting time. You know, the whole community did all sorts of simulations, discovered all sorts of neat things. Now we're at a stage where it's more the practical side of how do we take this information and use it to detect these things. Mm-hmm. And there is the modeling work that I started to get into, which is, okay, we can't do a numerical simulation for every one of these cases. What can we do? What can we figure out to make it possible for LIGO to have the best chance it possibly can have of seeing these things. And so that's what pushed me into the general waveform modeling side of things.
And are there any sort of practical applications for the relevant to the discovery, or is the technology that has come into existence thanks to this research, does it have any use outside of the realm of theoretical astrophysics?
One thing is, we never, when we're doing fundamental basic research, we almost never know at the outset, oh, and this is going to make a better Blu-ray mm-hmm. player. Those things always come out, though, when you're pushing the forefront of technology. This instrument is doing things that have never been done before. It's inevitable that it'll have lots of technical applications in industry or what have you. To say that's why we do it would be a lie. That's not at all why we do it. We do it because this is the only way to learn how these things are happening, that these black holes are merging out in the universe. And I kind of think of it, I get this question a lot. In a way, it's similar to, oh, well, are there any practical applications to, Mozart composing music, or to, mm-hmm. Van Gogh painting, or what have you. We are creative human beings, and by our nature, we want to understand the world around us. And there was no other way to understand this thing. So I think that's really why I got into it, and a lot of other people did. And I think that is, very worthwhile on its own.
Do you have any advice for young people or lay people in general who are interested in physics, or specifically astrophysics?
So I think the biggest piece of advice would be, don't get discouraged early on. Don't think you can't do the math. I got a C in my first semester of calculus as an undergraduate, which might not sound that bad, but that was the first grade like that I had ever gotten, and there was a moment of panic of, oh no, I can't do the math. And it wasn't that, it was just that I hadn't figured out how I could learn these things yet, and it took some time to get through that. So if you're passionate about the astrophysics and the physics, you find a way to push this stuff into your brain, and it's a question of persistence. I am not talented in math, for example, in any way, nor are many of the great physicists I've known in my career. You don't have to be. So I think that would be the number one piece of advice, is that's okay, stick with it, and persistence will pay off eventually.
I was wondering if you could speak to kind of the general practices within each institution, and kind of within each university, are there like interdisciplinary practices, and are you working between departments, and how do they differ from each other?
Yeah, so I think this endeavor works best when there is interdisciplinary work. So right now I have very active collaborators in math, because again, that's not my forte. But in computer science, et cetera, these all overlap and are all essential pieces to the puzzle. There are places I've been where there isn't that much overlap, and you can see it in the output and in the creativity of the things that are generated. When you get these people from disparate backgrounds, often a computer scientist will make a suggestion about the physics that it never occurred to you, because you've had it drilled into your head that this is how it has to work for so long. So I think there's so much good creativity that comes from that sort of overlap. And the best places I've been have a lot of that, including the Aspen Center for Physics, which is a wonderful location for this sort of interdisciplinary interaction.
It's time to close Radio Physics. Thank you so much, Sean McWilliams from West Virginia University, and Mason DuBoeuf from Aspen High School, and Foster Lemkow from Glenwood Springs High School. Tune in to Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30. For more information about our Gopher program and events at the center, please visit the Aspen Center for Physics website at aspenphys.org.